the 4 issue of Christianity Today lead article entitled How Small Groups Are Transforming Our Lives. And this is the beginning of a sequence of articles in Christianity Today on the subject. And this first article is a report of a 3-year national research project that reveals how small groups are dramatically changing communities and churches. One of the things that I noted from this article was that at present, 4 out of every 10 Americans belongs to a small group. That surprised me. 4 out of every 10, a group that meets regularly and provides caring and support for their members. This is not simply informal gatherings of friends and neighbors, but it's an organized group, a Bible study group, an AA group, 12-step group, singles group, book discussion group, sports and hobby groups, political civic groups. Those who have joined these groups testify that their lives have been deeply enriched by the experience. They have found friends, received warm emotional support, overcome life-threatening addictions, and grown in their spirituality. They have learned how to forgive others and become more accepting of themselves. The thing that still shocks me about that is 4 out of 10. Would you have guessed it that high? I continue in this article. It says, what is happening now has never occurred at any previous time in history. Small groups are not only attracting participants on an unprecedented scale, they are also affecting the ways in which we relate to each other and how we view God. A majority of the small group members say that they joined because they wanted to deepen their faith and that their sense of the sacred has been profoundly influenced by their participation. And then this little header here. The deity of small groups is a God of love, comfort, order, and security. Gone is the God of judgment, wrath, justice, mystery, and punishment. That has some troubling thoughts. Now under the heading Cultural Shift, understanding small groups' impact begins with realizing how pervasively the movement affects our culture. The sociologist Robert Werthenau calls the movement, in effect, a quiet revolution. George Gallup likewise links small groups to societal changes. If the 60s represented the movement decade, the 70s the me decade, the 80s the empty 80s, then perhaps the 90s will become known as the decade of healing. Gallup believes such a label is appropriate in view of the millions of Americans who have joined small, nurturing, and caring groups seeking help for psychological, physical, emotional, or spiritual problems. Why do so many seek the solace of small groups? Gallup cites several reasons, all dealing with the impersonalness and the fragmentation of today's society. We live in an addicted society, whether to chemicals or to self-indulgence. 6 out of every 10 new marriages will end in divorce. 7 out of 10 people are so detached from their communities they do not know their neighbors. Loneliness is widespread. Privatism contributes to a go-it-alone philosophy in religious matters. The small group movement, according to Gallup, appears to be bringing us back together, answering what seems to be one of the central needs of our era, the need for an intimate and healing community. And then one other quotation I share with you, because it's from Carl George, who was my teacher at Fuller Theological Seminary and is the director, or was the director of the Institute there for Church Growth, and proponent of the meta-church paradigm, which focuses on leadership development through small groups. Points to an additional, even more basic need in today's culture, and I'm quoting from Carl George now. In an alarming number of cases, the biological family is not functioning well. People are increasingly unable to find the support, acceptance, belonging, positive role modeling, and sense of normalcy they need from home. A cell, small group, is a place where people have enough reference points socially to find themselves sustained emotionally and spiritually, end of quote. While the emotional support of a small group is different from that of a family, a group, says Carl George, provides a context for meeting needs for intimacy and trust. I've asked Gene to duplicate these articles, and they're available on the lobby table in its entirety, including the following article in Christianity Today. I think we have enough for maybe one for every other family, and you can decide whether you are the other or whether you are the one, but if you would like to pursue that. And it is against that backdrop that I would like to go back to Acts chapter 2 and ask you to really focus and to hear the word of the Lord for you today. Acts chapter 2, beginning with verse number 42. Courage, Troy. I can see him shaking his head back there, but it's going to get better. It's going to get better. Under the heading, The Fellowship of Believers, they devoted themselves to the apostles' teaching and to the what? And to the fellowship. To the breaking of bread and to prayer. Everyone was filled with awe. And many wonders and miraculous signs were done by the apostles. All the believers were together. Had everything in common, selling their possessions and goods, they gave to anyone as he had need. Every day they continued to meet together in the temple courts. They broke bread in their homes and ate together with glad and sincere hearts. It was okay to laugh. Praising God and enjoying the favor of all the people, and the Lord added to their number daily those who were being saved. If you want to know how the early church functioned, if you want to get a little insight on how it worked, Acts chapter 2, verses 42 to 47 is probably the best passage of Scripture that we've got in all the Bible to just open the door and give us a little peek inside of the first century Christian church, correct? I mean, I don't know of any better one in all the Bible. And yet here's my dilemma. When I read this, I feel like that I'm standing on one edge of the Grand Canyon, looking across this huge abyss to the other edge, and somebody's telling me, okay, jump. You need to get from here to there. This seems so different, Ed, than where we are living in Southern California in 1996. That to reach this goal seems about as likely to me as being able to broad jump the Grand Canyon. Now, you may have won the broad jump at the Olympic Games. I don't care how good you are. But if you come up beside me at one edge of the Grand Canyon and there is a command given, jump to the other side, I don't care what a champion you are, we are all going to miss it, right? Any of our efforts would be rather paltry, even if you're a champion. And that, to me, is a little reflection upon this picture. How the early church functioned. I mean, we're so different. Our culture puts such a prime price on individualism. This seems to be running totally in the teeth of that, right? Our culture says, I'll do it my way. Don't bother me. Nobody crosses my boundaries and lives to tell about it. And then I have to stop and say, okay, Lord, what's the purpose of the church? What is the purpose of the church? What are we here for? Worship God. Okay? Celebrate His grace, His love, His mercy, His kindness. But before that, what's the purpose of the church? Something even deeper. I believe that when you really examine what's going on and you recognize the fact that everything in our personal lives, everybody's personal life in the sinful world is affected by chaos and disorder, that we are witnessing creation in reverse. You may think that someday there's going to come that time when everything's going to be peaceful and settled down and everything is calm and quiet and there'll be no more troubles or any more problems in your life that you have to worry about or in anybody's life that you care about. Wrong. What we're witnessing, particularly as we come into this time of the seven last plagues that are a counterpart to the 7 days of creation, when God moved upon the face of the deep and brought order out of chaos, we are now seeing the destruction of that order, and we are seeing chaos resulting out of God's order. As the angels that are holding back the winds of strife are turned loose, and more Satan is allowed to have his freedom and to demonstrate what the full fruits and results are of his government and his way of living, right? And so ultimately, what you're seeing is the opposite of creation week. And it will culminate with the seven last plagues, counterpart to the 7 days, seven last plagues. And then what do you have at the end? You have an abyssos. You have a bottomless pit. You have an exact period for 1,000 years that is a counterpart to what this world was before creation week, correct? Everything breaking down, everything coming apart, total chaos, total disorder. Satan is the god of disorder, disinformation, disease, death. God is the creator. He is the god of order, truth, health, life. So where does the church fit in? Where does the church fit in? What is the purpose of NCCF? Why do we have a church? We could all basically go it alone and worship God alone, and we could praise and worship God. This morning I walked outside with my bowl of cereal and just delighted in the glory of a new morning. It was a little chilly out in Fallbrook where I was walking around. I sensed that I wasn't going to be out there too long, but it was a gorgeous morning, an absolutely gorgeous morning. And as I had my prayer time and just looked out the window from a little warmer spot, I thought, wow, Lord, it is beautiful today. It is. And then when I was driving in, I used a tape. What is his name? Jeff Hunt. Remember when he was here a few weeks or months ago? A contemporary Christian artist, and he was singing one of these songs. Really touched me again this morning about the walls come tumbling down, you know, the walls breaking down, the walls breaking down the barriers. Ed, I think you requested that song to be sung twice that day because it was so apropos and so fitting. And again, I found myself able individually to worship God by myself. So why do we need the church? What is the purpose of the church? My friends, the church is God's agent for healing in the world. Its primary concern is to bring people together in right relationship to God and to each other. And to the extent that that happens, we're prepared to celebrate God when we come together on Sabbath. And to the extent that that doesn't happen, we're not prepared. It isn't going to happen. Our task as a church, as I see it, North Coast Christian Fellowship, is to provide a setting or structures that give opportunity for a healing ministry, people coming together. And I will say again, as I said last week and as I will say next week, that the small group meeting in homes, 3 to 12 people, offers the very best hope that that is actually going to happen. It is one of the best vehicles that we know of in society today to bridge the chasm between where we are and our text. And I'll read it again. They devoted themselves to the apostles' teaching and to the fellowship. North Coast Christian fellowship, to the breaking of bread, and to prayer. Everyone was filled with awe, and many wonders and miraculous signs were done by the apostles, and all the believers were together. They had everything in common, selling their possessions and goods they gave to anyone as he had need, and every day they continued to meet together. In the temple courts, they broke bread in their homes, and they ate together with glad and sincere hearts, praising God and enjoying the favor of all the people, and the Lord added to their number daily those who were being saved. Now, that sounds like a church I want to belong to. How about you? Would you vote for that one? Boy, I sure would, Betty. To get there, we face a problem. I've already alluded to it, and I just want to take dead aim. We don't want to do, most of us, what's required to get to this goal. It isn't something that's natural for many of us. You put me inside of a Baskin-Robbins ice cream store, and it is quite natural for me to eat ice cream. I have no problem with that. But you tell me that I need to commit one night a week, a new commitment out of my time, to a small group of people that at this moment I don't even know. And my first reaction is to say, sorry, Charlie, you got the wrong person. Because my time is precious. Whenever my responsibilities at work are finished, I want to go in, unplug the phone, let it go on the recorder, pull down the blinds, be with me, and don't anybody else intrude. I mean, isn't that the feeling of our age, our society? Yes or no? Are you folks hearing me, what I'm saying? Gene, is this making any sense? So what I'm saying is that what needs to happen runs directly in the teeth of our natural desires. And further, when I think of the fact that in order to have a successful small group enterprise in this church, that's not all that's required. That's just the beginning. Then I, as pastor, really get tired. Because I have sensed from sad experience in the past personally that not only do you have the groups and need to do what's required to start them, but that you need to be having another meeting weekly with the leaders. This is another appointment in my life that I don't have time for. And that there needs to be training and nurture going on and a real discipling process between church leadership and small group leaders that enable them to keep focus and direction and vision on what we're all about, or else the whole thing is just going to... And so I say again, it is a rather daunting task that is before us. Hence, the reason for the vote next week. There are times, I suppose, for every leader when you wonder if you're through. And you look around and you say, is anybody following me? Where are we going here? Or are we just whistling in the dark? And after 2 years of our church board voting to have small groups and nobody having the energy or willing to do it, finally, your church leadership reached the point of saying, folks, let's quit joking here. It's now or never. We do it, or else we face the consequences. And in this pastor's opinion, we might as well close. Close the doors. Now, I don't know if you have any background on this, but this church has a luxury that many churches do not have. And that is, we're not possessed by a building. We're not owned by a piece of property. We don't have to pretend. If there is not a church here, We can all say amen, close the doors, and walk away and go someplace where there is, right? Which is, I say, a luxury. That is something that many churches are not able to have, that freedom. I mean, at the Orange Church, you folks have a building, right? Built by, are the people that built the blood, sweat, and tears into that building, are any of them still around? That makes for a particular dynamic of ownership, both on their part and the building owning us. Welcome, my friend. Been a long time. It's good to see you. I say again, this church does not have that particular noose around its neck. And so, if we're not going to have a church here, we don't have to pretend. We can have a business meeting, and I've already contacted the conference. They will guide us through the process of disbanding. We could buy down the lease. In fact, it might not even be an expensive proposition at all. You know, we have 2 years left on our rental lease here, proposition in this building. And we can go out, as someone said, as missionaries and infiltrate other congregations with the concepts and the ideas and what we've been trying to do here for over 10 years at North Coast Christian Fellowship. The only other option that I see as your leader is to get serious about really having a New Testament Christian church and building Christian community. And as your leader, the only way to that I see is to have small groups. Hence the vote next week. A friend of mine by the name of Clarence Schilt, is anybody acquainted with Clarence up in the Loma Linda area? He's a pastor there, wrote a book on this particular subject. And Clarence Schilt listed in his book 5 areas of change, societal changes that have affected the whole situation that we're facing in doing and having church. And we are now living with the consequences of these changes. And I'd like to go through these quickly with you and just have you think very soberly and seriously about the implications of each one of these things, because we're all touched by it. The first area of change that Clarence Schilt highlights in his book is in the area of the family. Family. We've moved from the rural, close family, extended family, where everybody has their brothers and uncles and aunts and grandmas and grandpas and so forth within touching distance, maybe sometimes even too close, but anyway, they're there, to isolated families. Now, you no longer have your children close by, or your mother, your father close by, or your aunts and your uncles and your nieces and your nephews. They're scattered from hither to yon. They may be back in Philadelphia. They may be in New York. They may be digging out of a snowbank for all we know at this very moment. And from my generation as an early baby boomer born in 46, I think I just barely caught that tide on, there is an increasing affluence that also promotes this separation and this distance. People have moved up and apart, up and apart. We used to have mothers at home every day when the children came home as the glue holding society together and the families together. When I was growing up, my mom was always at home. I mean, she was calling to make picture appointments for a photographer on the phone to make money at home. She was stamping envelopes for Dad in the office at home. She was doing anything she could do, but she was at home so that when we came home from school, we would have that. Well, do you know what? It isn't so anymore. I mean, if we were to count the number of families in this church where the kids come home and mom or dad is at home every day, it would be very, very few, right? I mean, that just isn't happening anymore. Kids come home to an empty house and are quickly given the message, you better take care of yourself. You're independent. You're on your own. Take care of yourself. Learn how to paddle your own canoe. And so even little children can feel lonely and can feel isolated and very independent. Our culture has produced an entire society now of people who think that nobody really cares. Someone has jokingly said, though, if you buy into that too totally, just skip two car payments, and you'll discover that somebody really does care. But the second area of change that impacts us very directly is what's happening in our neighborhoods. Boy, Art, you know, I hear you. And I've heard, how long has this been? 2 or 3 years that you have been, or more than that, you've been facing challenges in your neighborhood. Most of us don't have a clue to what a traditional neighborhood was, where there was a connectedness, a support structure, a neighbors knowing neighbors. Now we live in apartment complexes and condominiums, and we live in housing tracts, and everything that can be done to foster anonymity and the great P word, privacy. Privacy, right? I mean, now I've lived for 6 or 8 months in Fallbrook, and I don't know any of my neighbors. I don't know any of my neighbors. I mean, I barely know the name. I think I can pull up the name of my next door neighbor, and I've seen him a few times in the yard, invited him over a time or two, nothing's happened. And, you know, I mean, we are, boy, going in separate directions about as fast as we can go, and it just isn't happening. Privacy, isolation, even in our neighborhoods. It's interesting what's happened in pastoral visitation in recent years, because, you know, it used to be that you could count on people being quite happy if you'd stop by as a pastor. Well, now, two dilemmas. One, you can stop by, but nobody's going to be there. And number two, if you do happen to catch people at home, I mean, people are running so ragged and so frantic that it's sometimes embarrassing, because you're catching them and they need to be out the door to this appointment or that appointment, or they're running to pick up the kids or whatever. And so if you don't call ahead, I mean, you know, it's a difficult situation. Third factor that Clarence Schilt points out in his book, he talks about what is happening in the workplace. Changes in the work setting have increased loneliness and separation. No longer can you go to work for a company and plan on being there for the duration until your retirement. Now you're facing the prospect of frequent job changes and mobility. Loyalty goes where? Goes down. You don't have the close bonds with people even at work. Life continues to become more fragmented, more discontinuity even in the workplace. People in the past knew each other in more than one setting. They saw each other at work. They saw each other in the community, in the neighborhood. They saw each other as their kids related to each other at school. They saw each other at church. They had many different connections that overlapped. Guess what? Did anybody here see anybody else in this fellowship last week? Yeah, that's right. You did. A couple did. That's right. A couple did. Yeah. And then the mobility factor in our culture has made it so that there is such a turnover. You know, as we look at the people, for example, even in this little fellowship that we have lost the last 4 or 5 years, and you talk about the neighbors and the Sam and Mary Ann and the Betty Kellys and the Harveys and the, you know, we've got a back two, what is it, two pages now full of families that have moved over. Turnover is incredible. At Southern Missionary College, Ed, you remember you came there to do a seminar with me, and I was very idealistic my first year as pastor. Boy, I was out to learn names, you know, concentrate, focus. I wanted to be able to call people by name. Guess what? It was impossible. It was impossible. I was facing 1,000 new students every few months there. I mean, they just, you know, and I would stand at the door and I'd greeting people after church. And it was just a daunting task. I almost didn't want to go to the door, because these people would just come at me like a river, an army, you know, of people just coming through. And my goodness, it was pretty soon all I could do was say, Happy Sabbath. God bless you. Happy Sabbath. God bless you. You know, I didn't even want to get started on the name business because I was just swamped. And that's the way it is in life for many, many people. So contemporary living is fragmented and has many discontinuities. We all struggle with the pain of loss. People that we've been close to that are gone. They're gone. Number four is a shift in the area of values. Presently, relationships get a very low priority. Success in job, material prosperity, that's at the top. All of our time and our energy is zapped up in income production with little left over time or energy to build relationships. We are driven to get ahead. The dominant metaphor of our culture is race. Life is a race. By the way, how fast will your car go? Isn't it wonderful? The speed limits have finally been lifted. Wouldn't you love to be in Montana? No speed limits. What's that? Is that right? Leave it to Ed. I want to talk about that some more. I haven't slowed down. Maybe other people have, but oh my. So we're flying in the face of our culture in that respect. And the fifth area that I would point to from Clarence Schilt's book is even in the area of entertainment. We have moved from participation in entertainment to becoming spectators. TV, professional sports foster this. We become passive consumers. We become critical spectators, very poor participants, undependable participants. And it's not hard to see why when you add all these factors together of what's happening in the family and the workplace and values, society as a whole, in all of these areas, it's not hard to see why. There is such a pull in our culture. There is such a vacuum pull toward individualism and isolationism. There is a breakdown of natural relationship support structures that has left us independent, isolated, and lonely, even in the church. And what has broken my heart as pastor is I have sensed that rather than going counterculture, we have in the church, North Coast Christian Fellowship, been merely reflecting our culture and been experiencing the same problems here that culture in general has been experiencing. And so I have to stop and ask myself, what difference are we making? Quote, what a pity so many people are living with so few friends. When the world is full of lonesome strangers who would give anything just to be somebody's friend. Once again, I'd like to ask you to hear the word of the Lord. They devoted themselves to the apostles' teaching and to the fellowship, to the breaking of bread and to prayer. Everyone was filled with awe, and many wonders and miraculous signs were done by the apostles, and all the believers were together. They had everything in common, selling their possessions and goods they gave to anyone as he had need, and every day they continued to meet together. In the temple courts, and they broke bread in their homes, and they ate together with glad and sincere hearts, praising God and enjoying the favor of all the people, and the Lord added to their numbers daily those who were being saved. How did the early church function, and how can we possibly get there? Since the church is God's agent of healing, its primary concern has got to be bringing people together in right relationship to God and to each other. We would expect the church to be the one place on planet Earth where relationships are valued above everything else. The tragedy is that many people come to church and they find it just mirroring contemporary society. Rather than relieving the isolation and the loneliness experienced in society, many of you folks have come to this church and have walked out the door and have said, this is only reinforcing it. Let me share this illustration from softball. Some of you people probably think I only talk about football and the Dallas Cowboys all the time. This is softball. We had finished the game 2 hours earlier, and we're sitting at a large round table in Luigi's. Pizza had been ordered. In the meantime, we were sipping soft drinks or beer. The air in Luigi's was wet and warm. Other softball players, some from our team and many from other teams, crowded the tables around us. The sweat from the game was only partially dried, adding to the locker room atmosphere. But the effect was not at all unpleasant. It was happy camaraderie and cave-like sense of well-being and isolation from the outside world. Loud conversation filled the room. Pardon me, the subject was softball. At our table, we replayed our victory in detail, playfully chiding those who had made mistakes, congratulating the night's heroes. Other nights, the talk might have been of defeat, and we would have agonized over those same mistakes and wondered just what's wrong with our ball club. In either case, the talk was sincere and easily understood by everyone. We were teammates, and teammates behave that way. I have often wondered about the easy camaraderie on softball teams. I have played for 22 years. Why is conversation so easy? Why are friendships so quickly made? How can the ambiance be so accepting that even the poor guy who made a game-costing error is quickly accepted by all once we get to Luigi's? It certainly isn't because we are so much alike. I look around the table and I see a tool and die maker, a well-to-do suburbanite who sells paper, a high school teacher, a football coach, and a retired Navy officer. Occasionally, out of a curious sense of courtesy, perhaps we ask one another about our jobs, but no one listens very closely to the answers. Sometimes the feelings are heard. If one of our number has been fired or received a promotion, it is occasion for commiseration or congratulation, but I can't tell the tool and die maker what it's like to edit a magazine, and he can really tell me not much about his business. Nor is it because we have discovered some magic formula for conversation. We have varying abilities to articulate concepts and feelings. We say the wrong things. We stumble for words. We interrupt one another. We miss obvious signals of distress and need. No, I've decided the reason things work for us is because we share a common passion. Softball. We revel in it. We love to talk about it. We can recall details of games 10 years earlier with uncanny accuracy. We can analyze our current team's strengths and weaknesses for hours on end. We can talk with evangelistic fervor about strategy and our future prospects. No conversation ever strays from softball for any significant length of time. The best times I've ever had with church people have many elements in common with the softball fellowship I have just described. Boy, I'd like to just stop his quote parenthetically and say amen to that. They have occurred not because we were alike. My church is made up of people from all classes, varied occupations, and all age levels. They haven't occurred because we have discovered some new formulas for resolving conflict or encouraging one another or discussing the issues of the day. The best times have come when we all focused our conversations on our passion for Jesus and the consequences that passion has for our present church and the church that we want to be in the future. We share a common passion. Do we not? Quoting from Psalms, "How good and pleasant it is when brothers live together in unity. It's like precious oil poured on the head, running down on the beard, running down on Aaron's beard, down upon the collar of his robes. It is as if the dew of Hermon were falling on Mount Zion. From there the Lord bestows his blessing, even life forevermore." How did the early church function? One last time, I put before you the biblical word of evidence. They devoted themselves to the apostles' teaching and to the fellowship, to the breaking of bread and to prayer. Everyone was filled with awe, and many wonders and miraculous signs were done by the apostles. The believers were together, and they had everything in common, selling their possessions and goods they gave to anyone as he had need. Every day they continued to meet together in the temple courts. They broke bread in their homes. They ate together with glad and sincere hearts, praising God and enjoying the favor of all the people. And the Lord added to their number daily those who were being saved. It's my conviction that this church is really at a crossroads, and that I, as your leader, would do you a disservice if I didn't challenge you to either in the nomenclature of the card game to show your hand, to either play or quit. And I've never done this before. So the vote next week will be a first in my experience. When I contacted the conference president and said to him what I was doing, and I asked him for guidance, he said, "Jerry, I haven't had any experience with this either." But we're going to be doing this next week. We're going to be passing out a ballot to be filled out by any and every member of North Coast Christian Fellowship that will determine that largely the future of this church. You say, is this an official business meeting next week? Is this an official binding action? No. This is an opportunity for the members of this congregation to give a statement of where they are really at. You won't even be putting your name on this ballot. Roger and I decided to do it without a name so that nobody would feel like they had to vote a certain way based upon, you know, the board getting together and looking through the ballots and saying, "Oh, why'd she say that?" or "Why'd she say that?" Okay? So in that sense, it will be an anonymous ballot. We're going to watch them carefully so that nobody can stuff the ballot box. Was that your suggestion, Hazel? I may even number them. But we do seriously want to know where this church is going. Do we have the will, the determination to have a church and to move forward here or not? Because if we don't, we will do God a disservice by just continuing to pretend. The Lord has enough dead little churches strewn all over the country as an abomination against His name. We don't need to add to that pile.